Hello, I'm Adam Ferner.
And I'm Darren Chetty.
And welcome to Do You Even Vegan? This is the third instalment of our trilogy of interviews with top vegan philosophers, co-produced with The Philosopher, a Newcastle-based magazine edited by Anthony Morgan. In the previous two, we spoke to Eva Meyer and Gary Francione. Here, we chat with the excellent Sil Coe with introductions by Anthony. We're currently recording our reflections on these interviews, so keep your eyes and ears out for some post-chat analysis. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
To bring it to today, I would definitely like to give a big thank you to Darren Chetty and Adam Ferner. They're the hosts of the Do You Even Vegan podcast, which is a really super and slightly irreverent, not very serious podcast, considering it's on the topic of veganism. And they've hosted two events already today, which some of you may have already tuned into, and they've been absolutely superb as questioners and interlocutors. And I'm sure this final event of the day will be no exception. So just to introduce Sil Coe, who is going to be in conversation with Darren and Adam for this event. Sil is an independent researcher based in the United States. Her work currently focuses on the intersection of decolonial thinking and animal ethics, although in the chat just before this event, I think there's going to be a bit of philosophy of technology appearing on the horizon somewhere in the future. She's the co-author with her sister Afco of the influential 2017 collection Afroism, Essays on Pop Culture, Feminism and Black Veganism from Two Sisters. She's currently writing a book provisionally titled Human Beings and Being Human, which is the title of today's event. So I think that's probably a good point at which to hand over to Sil, Darren and Adam, and we can find out a bit more about Sil's project. So thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you, Anthony, for that warm introduction. I think for most philosophers to say it's not very serious is possibly the worst insult you can throw at them, followed by that's not really philosophy, is it? But I'm going to take it as the compliment that it was clearly intended as. The Do You Even Vegan podcast is a podcast that explores veganism, we hope personally, politically and playfully. We are interested in looking at issues and debates within veganism, so very aware that how vegans are often sort of presented as a homogenous group in the media. But we're also interested in thinking about how veganism relates to other social justice movements. If indeed we understand veganism as a social justice movement. I think that's why we're so excited to have Sil here today to talk about her contribution to Afroism and her work more generally. And I'm going to hand over to Adam, who's going to try and offer a rough summary of the book. We'll then see whether Sil is satisfied with that summary or feels that it requires some kind of correction.
Yes, yeah. And so apologies in advance. So the idea is just to kind of give audience members who aren't familiar with your work a kind of a jumping off point so that they can kind of get to grips, and hopefully in the questions afterwards we'll be able to finesse the view, because it's a wonderful book, and it's so complex without being complicated and capacious in its kind of purview as well, which is really wonderful. So it's a collection of essays, Afroism. Great title, wonderful, which is co-produced with AFCO, and it covers a broad range of topics, but obviously there are these common threads running throughout, even as your thoughts change and develop. And I think that's one of the things that I found really exciting, is that your position does kind of fluctuate while you're writing. So one of the threads is the conceptual connection between treatment of animals and white supremacy. And you bring a much needed decolonial lens to bear on the contemporary discussions of animal rights. Obviously, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get into everything in the depth that it deserves now. But one place I thought we could start is your interest in the distinction between humans and animals. So in your essay, By Human, Everybody Just Means White, you make the point that the human-animal distinction is constructed along racial lines. It emerges out of a racist hierarchy created by white supremacist patriarchal society that positions white European men at the top, figuring people of color further down and non-human animals at the base. as such, when the distinction is invoked in, for instance, civil rights settings and claims like I'm not an animal, a colonial invention is inadvertently reasserted. So this is a quote from the book: when we attempt to humanize ourselves and when we glamorize the human, we uphold the superiority of whiteness. This leads you to the view expressed in the essay, addressing racism requires addressing the situation of animals. So against this backdrop, veganism might be seen as being born out of a critique of neoliberal humanistic white supremacy. So yeah, that's a potted view of my appreciation of your book. So I think, Darren, you've got a first question as well.
Well, yes, to kick us off, it's kind of a why did you write the book type question, but it seems that you're writing about the welfare of animals, but you're also engaged in a critique of what we talk about as the vegan movement, which is something that Adam and I are very interested in. Could you tell us why both of these things were important for you to address in the book?
I think the two always go hand in hand. You know, if you're going to be performing an inquiry or an analysis of something, especially if it's ethical, right, because you're probably not the first person to have thought of those questions. Humans tend to ask the same ethical questions over and over again, just in new forms. Every time you perform an inquiry or you're performing an analysis, you are somehow addressing or in conversation with the tradition of other people who've asked those questions. Maybe you don't make it explicit. In our case, we did make it explicit because of the format that we were writing in. So for people who aren't aware, aphorism is actually just a collection of blog posts. So that explains the brevity of the chapters and also why we can't really go into a lot of depth, and you know, we can't really go into all the cool moves that one could make. My sister wrote a book last year, or she published a book last year, which goes more into depth in the way that she sees things. I've been working on a book about how I see things. So I want to just say this up front. I want to use a clarification that the philosopher Lewis Gordon makes between a criticism and a critique, because unfortunately it's been brought to my attention that a lot of people want to use aphorism as a way to discourage people from reading works in the canon, which was never my intention. So Lewis Gordon, he draws a distinction between a criticism, which is a sort of negative assessment or a wholesale rejection or dismissal of points of views, as if to say, you know, this is crap and the way I'm thinking about things is the right way to think about things, versus a critique, which I think he uses the language, a loving engagement with material. And I can't speak for AF here, and nothing I say, you know, I'm saying on behalf of AF, this is just for myself. My contributions to Aphorism and the work that I've been doing since, I consider a loving engagement with the vegan movement, which I see myself as a part of, and which I believe people should read anything, you know, anything on the side of animals, I think people should read. So I just want to make that clear. And so the critique or the loving engagement that I was involved in is around the issue with the human-animal binary, generally speaking. I became concerned after reading a lot of animal ethics and just animal advocacy literature in general. I became concerned that it seemed like in mainstream vegan thinking, people wanted to preserve the human-animal binary, but shift the weight. And I was very concerned about that because I've never heard of any movement that's aware that a binary is the cause of the negative treatment, wanting to preserve the cause. So for instance, the way that we think of, let's say, the human-animal binary is that the human, right, the concept or the idea of the human is arbitrarily weighted, so more morally weighty, and as a result, the animal has no weight, right, or less weight. And so what animal advocates want to do in the mainstream is they want to, as Peter Singer says in one paper, desanctify the human so that we can elevate the animal. So shift the weight like this, right? Like, ugh. And for me, I became concerned. I'm like, wait, this is still happening. That means that human and animal are still in a binary type oppositional relationship. You're just shifting the weight. And it seems like if we want to liberate animals, which we want to do physically, of course, and we want to liberate them from the system, we also want to liberate these ideas from a binary kind of system. And so this is where my critique, you know, really comes from. It's looking at what's going on in the vegan movement and saying this is it's beautiful what the project is, but the way that we're going about doing it is actually keeping in place this very problematic binary. There were some other vegans who came along. My sister, she was, I think, part of the inception of intersectional veganism. And I think they thought they were doing something really radical. And I saw the same thing happening. I saw that they were still using this binary thinking. And I think actually explaining or describing the situation of animals as speciesism is part of keeping this human-animal binary in place. And I saw that that was still happening even in their conversation. And even worse, for me, I didn't see an ethical argument as to why it's wrong to treat animals a certain way. I saw it as more of an instrumental kind of argument, namely, you can use it as a way to harm other humans. And so I became very disturbed, you know, when even radical or so-called radical vegans were, you know, critiquing the movement. And so this is where my critique was born.
So I just want to follow up, and it's not a challenge. It's about me trying to clarify here. Is there any sort of extent to which a distinction between human animals and non-human animals is useful, worth preserving, or worth having, in your view?
Yes.
Can you give us say a little bit more about that?
So there's lots of different species, right? So there's a whole bunch of animals, a whole bunch of different species. And there's one way that you can think about it, right? You can think about it in this external way, that human is just another animal, which is true, right? On a scientific level, we're just another animal. And so we can make these assessments about being human from an external point of view, right? We can do some empirical research, and we can point to all the properties and attributes and features of humans and do that about bats and about elephants and dogs and cats. And it's true. There's nothing that you can say about being human that is different in a moral level from any other animal, right? Any one thing you can find some other animal has, right? And that's sort of the argument a lot of utilitarians make. They're like, what is it about being human that's so special in this moral sense? But what no one ever mentions is that there's something different now going on when we're the ones performing this inquiry. We have this external perspective of what it is to be human, but because we're human, we also have an internal perspective. This is the departure point for Black veganism. It's taking the internal perspective of being human and forming an animal ethic from that. Now, that's not to say that other animals don't have subjective lives. That's not the point. The point is that we have to remain silent about them because we are not them. Now, let's say bats were stupid enough to do philosophy. Okay, and now I'm a bat. It's a different world. I'm a bat now. I'm going to say, listen, there's this external way I can think about being a bat, which is, you know, a bat is lined up with any other animal and I can make all these empirical, you know, assessments about it. But there's this other way about being a bat that no other animal I can say about, and that is this internal perspective. And so if I was a bat, I was going to say, and in that regard, I'm talking about being a bat, and that I can't talk that way about humans or elephants or blah, blah, blah. And now again, if we're in a third, you know, different universe and I'm an elephant, now the elephant is gonna say, I have two different perspectives on this one species by virtue of being a member of it that I don't have on other species. So I just mean in that sense, that of course that's an important distinction. That's why people are, you know, that's why it's weird if you say, I don't wanna have sex with this kind of person, you know, Chinese person, where people say, well, that's weird. That's why does it matter? Versus no one's gonna think it's weird if you don't wanna have sex with a cat, right? Right there, you see, there's a really important a human-animal distinction. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we have to be careful here that a human-animal distinction is not the same thing as a human-animal binary. In the same way that, for instance, if you look at gender differences, right? So there are men and there are women and there are others, but let's just, you know, let's go back in time when it was only men and women. Well, you know, saying that there's a man and a woman, or that they're men and women, in and of itself, that's not a problem. The problem is when you put them in this oppositional binary relationship, such that if you're making claims about one, you thereby are also making claims about the other. I don't think anyone wants to say we have to get rid of this idea that there are genders. We just want to get rid of the idea that they stand in relation in a certain way. And I think that there's something similar with the human and the animal as well. Anyone who wants to say that we have to completely get rid of any distinction between human and animal, this is an absolute pretense. It's not going to work.
Okay. It's great that you've mentioned that. Can I just ask one more before I'll give way to Adam? I don't want to hog this. You talk in the book a lot about the way that people of color, Black people in particular, have been animalized, the way that in a sort of natural science order of humans with non-human animals below, we've also got this substructure of racism from sort of Linnaeus and even before. But what interested me, and I guess surprised me at first, but I think I'm making sense of it. It's, you know, you have to be patient with me sometimes, is I think as Adam mentioned in the introduction, what you don't do is the move that some people make, which I guess is the, am I not a man? Ain't I a woman? Of wanting very clearly for Black people to be incorporated into the position of human, as of course they should. And I've, you know, been around sort of anti-racist groups where there's often been a real sense of, we need to be very clear that we're not dehumanized and animalized. You're doing something that's slightly different, and I'd like you to take a few minutes to explain what that is, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of confusion in Afroism. And again, in the reader's defense, you know, I did try to write 30 pages of a blog post, and Af, you know, she was the one who's in charge of the blog. She was like, are you kidding me? She was like, come on. So so I had to sacrifice some details there. Right. So I'm not advocating that, you know, for instance, you know, people of color or other marginalized groups. I'm not suggesting that you pretend you're not human. I was trying to draw attention to pay attention. You know, what do you mean when you say, I'm human? What are you talking about? There's a difference between the concept human, and then a particular conception of human. There's a problematic conception of human, I call it capital H, that's in operation, and that this is what we would call the one that's tangled up in all of the isms. Sylvia Winters, who's a cultural theorist and historian, she talks about this. And a lot of the people who follow her work are also trying to make this point about what post-humanism means. Are we trying to move past the idea that we're human beings, or are we trying to move past a problematic conception of human? And that's the side that I'm on, that there's a particular conception of human in which you find this binary, but that that all conceptions of human need not be that. So I talk about this because, and especially in the context with animals, because there's this problem in which animal advocates want to use these isms that are dehumanizing people as a model to explain and describe animal oppression. And this for me is completely wild. I understand why they're trying to do it. It just doesn't work. So if you look at any human oppression, and if you understand why they're wrong, now this can be, you know, racism, sexism, ableism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. I want to include also outgrouping because of political affiliation, because in the United States, there are people literally stabbing each other on the street because of who they voted for. And they are using this kind of language. You're a subhuman because you voted for whoever, right? This is happening. They're using that language. Whenever you have this kind of human injustice going on to the point where you have really egregious treatment of these people, what's happening is that you are excluding a particular human community or a particular human from the idea of human. That's where the negative charge comes from. It's not as simple as you're making a morally arbitrary trait or feature or property morally relevant. That's not where the badness of racism comes from. The badness of racism comes from you are using race as a reason to exclude a group of people from the idea of humanity, which means you must understand that there's something morally laden about the idea of human, or else, again, you can't explain the badness of any human oppression. Now, if you move over to the way that mainstream animal advocates are talking about animal oppression, and they want to use racism and sexism and other human oppressions as a model, you have a big problem. If the negative charge of human oppression comes from excluding humans from the idea of human, and you want to say now that the idea of human is an arbitrary idea, you've now lost the grounds for explaining what makes those things wrong. And on top of it, if you don't want to do that, if you want to say, okay, yeah, that's true, excluding people from the idea of human is wrong, and so there's something going on there with that idea of human. On top of that, animal oppression isn't removing animals from the, or excluding animals from the idea of human. There's something different going on. And so I think animal advocates are actually undermining the extent to how bad animal oppression is by trying to force it into the same category as human oppression, that we should acknowledge there's something very different about humans oppressing one another or performing injustices against one another from animals. And that's a good thing. We should keep that divide because there are two different mechanisms going on. Now, there's a way that they you can talk about them all together. And that's what Afroism was really all about. How do we talk about these two very different phenomena, these human-human oppressions, which, by the way, even those singular ones are different. Sexism is not like racism, and racism is not like homophobia, and homophobia is not like Islamophobia, blah, blah, blah. But what they all have in common is that this is a mechanism in which you exclude humans from the idea of human, which is why people are right to say, I don't feel human, or other people will call them animals. They're right to feel that way. It's not a coincidence that we go straight to that language, because that is happening. And there's something different happening with animals. And so our work was trying to explain, how can we talk about all these things all together in a way that doesn't compromise the difference between the kinds of oppressions that are happening?
I suppose I kind of wanted to encourage you to say a little bit more about the malleability and fluidity of the distinction. So one thing that I'm thinking is that occasionally there are instances where the human-animal binary is twisted by oppressive groups in order to legislate certain types of behavior. And I'm thinking perhaps of like predatory sexual behavior, where in order to present defenses of abuses, men will talk about their animal nature. So that clearly is a reversal of that human-animal distinction. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that.
So I want to make clear, and I hope I did this in Afroism, I certainly do it in a lot of my talks in which I'm talking about the work for my new book. What we're doing is not trying to provide an exhaustive taxonomy about how we use human-animal. There are just too many ways. I'm specifically focusing on two types of human-animal distinctions that we make, because they're relevant to the conversation about animal ethics. At the heart of this, and always what's in the foreground, is the treatment of animals. How do we liberate animals from an oppressive system? How do we make people, or get people, to think about animals in a way that gives them the dignity they deserve? Because that's always my focus, I'm focused only on those distinctions that I think are going to be relevant to a particular debate in animal ethics that I'm contributing to. So I'm focused on the human-animal distinction understood in this more biological sense that kind of mainstream people will use, namely, humans are members of the kingdom Animalia. And so when we're saying human, we're really saying human-animal. And that's where you get, we are all animals, that kind of talk happens. Then there's this response to that kind of thinking, for instance, Cora Diamond, Bernard Williams, Doug McLean, where they're going to argue, there's a sort of ontological distinction. There's the experience of being human, which is different from, just saying being a human animal. And I'm talking about a third kind of distinction. So if the first one is talking about human beings, we are all animals. And the second one is being human, we're not animals, we're humans. I'm doing a third one, which is the feeling human and seeing people as human, which is some humans are animals. These are the only three human-animal kind of conceptions that I'm interested in my work. And so you're right, we use them, we use them in all kinds of different ways. But because it's not lending to my argument about an animal ethic, because remember, I'm trying to come up with an animal ethic that's not going to be rooted in anything about actual animals. That's what's revolutionary about our view, right? Because a lot of times people want to look at scientific data and say, oh, look, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, no, we don't. That's not how we're going to get a good animal ethic off the ground. And also, especially science can change, and it's not going to affect my view that we're trying to ground our animal ethic in something else. And that is on pushing against this idea that there's a race narrative.
Darren, did you want to follow up? Or I have plenty of questions, but I don't want to.
Go on, you take another one, Adam.
Well, I suppose it was just to kind of ask you to build on something that you, the association that you've mentioned already between this kind of the focus on the interiority and Black veganism. And I was just hoping that you could elaborate a little bit more about specifically that term Black veganism and what you see falling under it.
Right, yeah. Sometimes I feel I made a mistake calling it Black veganism because people think it means it's Black people who are vegan, which is really racist. I mean, there's lots of, as I find it hard to believe that all Black people are vegans for the same reason, right? Just like, people are vegans for different reasons. And so people are always like, oh yeah, and Bryce Harper and stuff. And I'm like, no, what? Yeah, she's Black. I mean, she's not doing Black veganism. I don't think she is, and so the point of calling it Black veganism was to merge together two ideas that seemed on the face of it, like, huh? right? So veganism, which we associate, of course, with animals, and then Black, which we, of course, Blackness we associate with race. And so I was trying to bring together this idea of anti-racism with the project of animals, and hoping to, that, you know, that people feel jarred when they see the title or hear the title, and that they would, you know, be drawn to it. And so there is a formal name. I call it subspecies internalism or subspecies subjectivism. In popular culture, we just call it Black veganism, because my view is probably more interesting to people who are familiar with the philosophical debate between people like Peter Singer and then like Cora Diamond or Bernard Williams. That's pretty much the foundation of my view. I'm agreeing with people like Cora Diamond or Bernard Williams, but saying, you're missing something here. Like you're not gonna get the argument off the ground without a consideration of race. And so my argument is really building on it. So I call Peter Singer type views like species externalism or species objectivism. I call this response, like by Cora Diamond or Bernard Williams, species internalism or species subjectivism, namely understanding what it means to be human from the subjective perspective. And then I call mine subspecies, because I'm going into, you know, human beings are the only people involved, and we're using a lot of human animal language. And so what does that mean? And trying to derive an ethic from there. Again, so yeah, I would need like a whole hour to really get into the mechanism of Black veganism in a way that would include non-philosophers.
Great. That was really helpful.
Let me ask a question that's very much sort of ground level. I guess Adam and I have been very interested throughout the podcast, in inviting vegans of color onto the podcast, very aware of the sort of, you know, the Instagram version of veganism, and how it's tied up with the sort of certain aesthetic and notions of well-being, etc. At the same time, one of the things that I've encountered often is this idea that in certain communities that food has a certain cultural affinities, value, and that in communities that have been historically marginalized in some ways, there's often this attempt in some anti-racist circles even to build anti-racist praxis out of a Black culture or an Asian culture, so that right-wing Asians will sometimes be criticized and accused for not being able to cook their dal correctly or eat it correctly and so forth. So one of the things I suspect is sometimes missing in veganism is an understanding of how food has a certain cultural value within certain communities, which runs the risk of essentializing to say that. And yet I am vegan and hold that, you know, we all should be. But I wonder whether there are any thoughts you have on how to manage that sort of grand reality, when sometimes it feels like we're trying to fit an ideal notion of why we should be vegan onto a situation where people aren't going to be receptive to the kind of arguments we're producing.
Mm-hmm. I'm such a bad person to ask this question to, because I'm a person who did have very strong culinary traditions that were rooted, let's say, in dairy and eggs. I didn't know what veganism was, so I was vegetarian for a long time. And then as soon as I heard what veganism was, I thought, that's me. The next day, I threw everything out, and I think I even made a whole bunch of cookies for a party or something, you know, and I was like, oh, that's gone. And I was a vegan the next day. For me, there was never this question about like, oh, what am I going to do about this dish that I love? You know, I just thought, well, I'm going to find a substitute for some of the ingredients. And if not, I'm not eating the dish anymore. And so for me, it wasn't that big of an issue. And as a result, I don't think about those things. So this is my short way of saying, I don't know how to answer the question, because I don't relate to the experience of being so wedded to a particular ingredient or a particular food that that would overshadow my ethical commitment.
Okay. And perhaps it's, yeah, I'm certainly not trying to position you as the expert on it. Do you think that the account I gave, is that something that rings true in your experience?
Yes. And I have some friends who you know, refuse to go vegan for that reason. And I have some friends who became vegan because, you know, they found a way to substitute a particular ingredient. Like that was all it took, was that, okay, now I have a way to make this dish that's so central to my family. I don't judge them for it, right? So when we talk about it, I'm not, you know, performing an evaluation of it, but it's something I personally just cannot relate to. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, it's something I don't know how to think about, though I can understand it because there's so many people close to me struggle with that issue. But yeah, okay. I don't get it.
And perhaps more generally, to what extent do you think coming up with the clearest arguments for veganism will impact on how the world becomes vegan. Let me just give you a bit of context. Adam and I are big fans of Simon Amstel's documentary Carnage, which I don't know if you've seen it. It's a vegan sci-fi. It's got elements of real footage mixed with dramatizations, and can be read as a sort of blueprint for how the world embraces veganism. And he says some things that you wouldn't tend to see in vegan discourse, like there's a couple of very attractive men who become like celebrity chefs. And the very fact that they have this sex appeal seems to motivate a lot of people. And of course, that sounds like a very, not the sort of argument a philosopher would be making, but it does seem to be someone who's very media savvy, understanding how social movements often sort of gain momentum.
Right.
So I guess I'm asking, what is the role of the philosopher in the vegan movement? Are they just doing some sort of background work? Are they actually affecting folks on the ground, and should they be?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so I don't think there's one way, or I don't, I never propose that there's a one way or one way to argue or one way to engage in people to make them think about animals, because people think differently. And that's what one of the beautiful things about, encountering many different beings, not just humans, right? And even I have different cats and they all have their own kind of thing going on. So some people, for instance, I have a really good friend. She's an extremely logical person and she does like philosophy of math and stuff. She was vegetarian for a long time. Every single day ate the same cheese sandwich regimen. And then, I told her one time I was talking about veganism, not even in an argument sense, but just like, oh, here are some things that people say about why you should be vegan. And literally on the spot, she was like, oh, that makes sense. I'm vegan now. Okay. That actually happened. Okay. Because that's the kind of person she was. I know another person, they stopped eating meat because they watched Bambi. Right. So they were moved by this cute little narrative. Someone else who went vegan because someone they really admire became vegan, and they said, well, I want to be like that person, which I don't think we should laugh at. I mean, this in ancient Chinese philosophy, they talk about the moral exemplar views, and this is a completely legitimate way of being ethical, that there's someone that you admire and you say, I don't know the reasons for why I should be vegan or why I should do this or this, but this person that I admire who's virtuous does it. And for that reason, I'm going to now become vegan. I don't ever push one way. And I actually don't even try to convince people. I moved away from that. I used to be this kind of militant vegan who's like yelling at people's faces at Chipotle. And then I had this experience that kind of jolted me out of that. And I changed my focus from trying to change people's minds to trying to understand, what do I have to do to always allow myself to have my mind changed? And so I saw, my contributions to Black veganism and my work now as not so much me trying to convince people of anything, but sharing my story of the things I was thinking about and the kind of experiences I had that brought me to thinking about animals much differently in terms of how I first became vegan, but also how I shifted from being this kind of more conventional vegan to being a vegan who completely, as you can see, I moved away from even thinking about it as speciesism to something that's very much connected to this larger narrative about race. And so this was more about me allowing myself to become mentally adventurous and kind of, surf on the thoughts of other people and open myself to listening to other people to allow myself to change, as opposed to trying to give some kind of argument or whatever.
One might worry that some people become vegan for the wrong reasons that ultimately reinscribe the kind of oppressive hierarchies. So I don't necessarily think that this is the wrong reason, but I do see that we were talking to Gary Francione earlier, and he puts a premium on personhood, and he makes this distinction between things and persons. And to my mind, his view of personhood is very deeply tied to a neoliberal Eurocentric model of the self. And that's something that I know that you have taken issue with. And so one can become vegan because of reasons that he presents, but if those reasons ultimately kind of undermine or reassert some of the problematic dynamics, do you think that that's an issue?
No, I don't. And sometimes you can even give the best argument, and then someone's going to hear another argument that's, very compelling, and they'll move the opposite way too. I mean, I try to be very careful when it comes to anything ethical, because usually most of these things are just stepping stones to the next thing or the next thing. I don't know what else to say. I don't think that there is a right reason to be vegan. Actually, I don't have a reason why I'm vegan myself. When people ask me, why are you vegan? I will literally tell you, I just don't really want to be the kind of person that's not affected by this. Like, for me to, like, what it is to be a good person is that you are moved by animals suffering or people suffering or the planet dying. If you ask me why, I don't have one for you. And I don't think I need one. In the same way as if you ask me, why do I love my partner? I'm going to probably squint at you. And I say, you want me to give you an argument for that? I'm going to say, I would probably begin to wonder, do you know what the word partner means? Right? Because what the word partner means is to already have inscribed within it certain parameters for what kind of interactions or what kind of judgments you're going to have about something. And that's how I honestly feel about veganism, that is something that's deeply related, tied into your soul, deeply tied into your character. And even if you do have an argument, this is just a way of articulating something, but that may not actually be the reason. I don't know if there's a reason. I think it's deeper than that. And that's why I don't really care why people are vegan. I don't really care why people are animal advocates. I am so deeply invested in this issue that I honestly do see anybody who's a vegan and anybody who's doing anything they can on the side of animals, I consider that we're kindred spirits. We might disagree on politics. We might disagree on religious stuff. We might disagree on, you know, who's the hottest celebrity at the moment. We might disagree about what music we like. And for me, I'm willing to sit there and let's hash it out because it's worth it that we have this bigger thing. And that's actually something that I love about being in the vegan movement, that you have people from all different walks of life who care about animals. And if it wasn't for that, I would have never sat in the same room with these people as some of the people that I call my closest, dearest friends, whose reasons I disagree with, whose politics I disagree with, everything I disagree with, but we sit there and we love each other because we believe that, listen, we need to care about what's happening with animals and we need to do something about this.
I listening to you say that, it sounds like it's a personal thing, and I could I think the comparison with why are you with your partner, etc., that makes sense to me. I guess a lot of vegans, and I think Gary certainly at lunchtime, there was this idea that part of being a vegan is to recruit. Yeah, it's not just a matter of personal conduct, but a matter of persuading others. I wonder if that's the case for you or whether you see that differently.
I don't think to be a vegan means that you have to be a recruiter, no. I think you, in a way, naturally are a recruiter. I don't think it's an intention, right? Sometimes it's a part of my life. So sometimes I'll just mention it. Like, oh yeah, I'm vegan, I can't have this. And a person will say, oh, why are you vegan? And then you start talking, right? You talk about your journey there, or you talk about whatever. And then they're like, oh, okay. Maybe they might think more about it too. I don't know. Maybe they don't. I don't know. I don't see my role as that I have to recruit. Gary and I might disagree. I love Gary. I mean, he was really influential in my becoming vegan, actually. But yeah, I don't agree with that at all.
Great. Fantastic. Thanks for listening to Do You Even Vegan, a podcast where we talk about veganism personally, politically, and when we're in a good mood, playfully. You can reach out to us on Twitter at DYEV1621. Darren's handle is at Rack Classroom. Any likes, thumbs up, comments, or general words of affirmation are always gratefully received. See you next time on Do You Even Vegan?